From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the Week in Review. We'll look at sexual harassment on Beacon Hill, the Manafort indictment, and the GOP tax plan. Also today, Boston schools and the mayoral race. City Councilor Tito Jackson says schools need more funding.
So the real issue is that a young Martin J. Walsh and a young Tito Jackson wouldn't fare as well in a Walsh administration based on the funding that's currently happening.
But Mayor Marty Walsh says more money won't solve BPS's problems.
You can't continue to fund schools that are losing enrollment at high levels. Throwing money at a situation and not fixing the problem is not the answer.
Plus, in our Future of Work series, how a Woburn factory is leading a new industrial revolution.
So this field is like the air in the room. Nobody notices it's there until it's gone.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, and that means it's time for the Week in Review, and we'll begin with stories of years of sexual harassment on Beacon Hill.
Everybody knows this has been going on. You know, I mean, I've covered politics for 20 years, and I worked at the State House for part of that time, and it was blindingly clear that it was going on Beacon Hill.
Governor Charlie Baker has ordered his staff to review sexual harassment policies.
We'll make clear in a very explicit way that none of this sort of thing will be tolerated.
And House Speaker Robert DeLeo says the legislature has a zero-tolerance stance on harassment, but he says it's also time for the legislature to take a look at its policies.
What I want to make sure is that the victims really get a sense of, that they're not going to feel any fear of bringing their story to the appropriate authorities.
And former Senate President Therese Murray, the first woman to hold that leadership position, also weighed in.
Sometimes in a particular generation, they haven't quite caught up to what the new rules are and thinks it's okay to make jokes and make comments.
Well, there's a great deal to discuss, and joining me to do so today is Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston and columnist for the Boston Globe and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Renee, it's good to see you again.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. We're also joined by Richard Tse, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. And Richard, it's great to see you as well.
Nice to be back.
I'm going to actually start with you, Richard, because you have firsthand experience on Beacon Hill. What was your reaction when you read these stories about so many women saying that they've had such difficulty with harassment?
Well, I kind of had an interesting background in that I went into the building in 1984. I was there in the 90s, left in 2010. And I remember when I first went in, you know, you'd hear the stories. I mean, back in the 60s and the 70s and the early 80s, you're totally in a different time period, obviously, than we're at right now. And I guess things have become very politically correct at the State House. Everybody's careful, you know, nowadays. But I'm surprised at still how much has been sort of bubbling up over the last couple of weeks, particularly in Yvonne Abrams' columns and so forth. And maybe it's me, and I'm oblivious, but, you know, I asked a couple of my former aides, and they were like, oh, yeah, didn't you know this, and, you know, and I'm, you know. So I think that the Senate president and the Speaker of the House are both fine people, and they, you know, they obviously don't want to see that type of atmosphere in either chamber, the governor, obviously. And I think that this is happening all around the country.
Yeah.
It's a national conversation, and they need to, you know, clean up their act institutionally and be at the forefront.
Yeah, you know, and I'm glad you mentioned Yvonne Abraham's name, because a great tip of the hat to her for her reporting to bring all these disturbing stories to us. And then they keep coming, right? Like, I was just, someone told me recently about the fact that she had arrived one day at a meeting with a representative, and she arrived early, and because there was no one else in the room, suddenly found herself being chased around the table by the representative. I mean, and then the way she was communicating to me, said it was kind of like par for the course, that it wasn't unusual at all. I mean, Renee, your thoughts?
Well, you know, I spent 8 years as a reporter at the State House, 5 for the Boston Phoenix when I was really quite young in my 20s, and then 3 for the Boston Globe. And, you know, everybody's experience is different. Mine was mostly, I was more likely to be sort of patronized or condescended to by men in power, you know, not sexually harassed, but basically, you know, not being taken seriously. That was my problem. But, you know, there is a certain culture at the State House, and I suspect at City Hall, too, let's say, as Yvonne pointed out, you know, it's there's a lot of long nights, there's a lot of late hours, there's a lot of drinking. And I think that, you know, it's sort of endemic. It's kind of epidemic to that culture. I think the, you know, Anita Hill brought this to light 25 years ago, or more than 25 years ago. And, you know, things haven't really changed that much. I do hope that given the sort of the power of the whole social media Me Too campaign, which I don't generally like the social media, but I do think that it elevates this, you know, concern or problem, which it is, to a higher level and could have some effects.
Well, so to that point of, you know, asking more about the culture on Beacon Hill, we did speak with Yvonne Abraham this week, again, the Globe columnist who brought all these stories to everyone's attention. And here's what she said about culture and the Massachusetts legislature.
There are legislators with a lot of power who don't really answer to anybody but the voters, and the business is built on relationships. And, you know, some women might be reading that situation as like the, you know, going to after hours events is something they need to do to network, and some of the men on Beacon Hill see it as something else.
Richard, today I want to ask you about this because, I mean, the other thing that I took that truly disturbed me from Yvonne's reporting was that basically nobody was willing to use their names because it's such a small, insular world where, I mean, this is politics, right? So relationships matter. That all these women were afraid if they spoke honestly and gave their names that it would completely deep-six their careers in Massachusetts.
No, and I totally understand it. But I do think, again, we're having a national conversation right now about sexual harassment in the workplace. And whether it's the State House, whether it's the media industry, I mean, NPR had a problem themselves, whether it's in academics or film and entertainment, I think what's happening right now is a really healthy thing. And, you know, any big institution has had these problems over the last few years, and probably maybe it's more accentuated at the State House for the reasons that you mentioned.
So you're right, and I'm glad you mentioned NPR, because we should be totally transparent about that and say that, yes, like the senior most news editor at NPR, Mike Oreskes, had to resign because of disturbing allegations around him and sexual harassment that date back decades from when he was also at the New York Times. But, I mean, my question is, you're right. We're at a moment where everyone's talking about it. So maybe people feel more empowered to say this happened to me. But what do we do to stop it? Right. Because like on Beacon Hill, and you guys know the culture of Beacon Hill, on Beacon Hill, as we heard earlier, you know, Robert DeLeo, the governor, et cetera, all saying, let's take a look at policies and training and things like that. I mean, is that enough or should more be done?
Well, I think there are some recommendations in that ad hoc women's committee that were made just recently that I think make a lot of sense. It's sort of hard to believe that members of the legislature and everybody who works at the State House doesn't have to go through mandatory harassment training. I mean, I've done that at least 10 times, I think, even in my little nonprofit I'm working for now. Every couple of years, you have to go through this training again. It's not perfect, but it does, you know, raise consciousness. So I think it's important to do. Go ahead.
Yeah, and you do have to do that in the State Senate right now. Mm-hmm. Senator Rosenberg, when he came into the presidency, implemented that, and it's a great credit to him. And I know that the Speaker has pretty much said that he's going to review all of the policies on the House side. And you know what? I think the best way to prevent this from happening in the future is just to go through exactly what we're going through right now and just, you know, have, you know, sort of rip the, you know,
veil off
mm-hmm. and just move forward from here.
You know, it is possible to change culture. I mean, it's important to remember that. You know, we all remember times when everybody was smoking all the time indoors. It wasn't, you know, the idea that you would have a bar where you couldn't smoke was laughable. People, you know, pick up after their dogs now, which never happened, you know, when I was a kid growing up. There are, you know, the whole drunk driving, you know, designated driver culture has taken root in, you know, our kids' generation. And I think it's important to remember that it is possible to change, you know, even deep-seated cultural norms. And, you know, we just have to get at it.
I mean, one of the ways to do that is to get more women in the legislature,
isn't it?
That
wouldn't hurt.
Yeah. And, I also want to say that as the stories trickle out, that most of what we've heard have been stories that women have. But I've also been hearing that some gay men as well have been saying that they've had some difficulties on Beacon Hill as well. So I wanted to not overlook that. But before we move away from the Massachusetts legislature, I just wanted to quickly ask you both about a piece of legislation that I didn't want us to forget about, because Massachusetts could soon become the first state to ban bump stocks. Those are those devices that you can add to a semi-automatic weapon to make it behave as much like a fully automatic weapon. And they were the devices used in Las Vegas, in the Las Vegas shooting, which was just last month. We've had some very terrible weeks, haven't we? And so Beacon Hill lawmakers have sent the legislation. They've passed it both House and Senate. They've sent it to Governor Baker, banning bump stocks and trigger cranks. And we have a little bit of tape here from State Senator Karen Spilka.
We are going after those devices, those two devices that can make guns and almost an automatic.
Yeah, and so the governor has said that he has previously expressed support for banning these devices. I just wanted to get reaction from both of you quickly on that, especially since the federal level legislation that people were talking about is gone nowhere.
Stalled, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and even the National Rifle Association, which doesn't like anything that even whispers about gun control, has said that they never intended these bump stocks to be used in this way to make automatic weapons. So, it seems a no-brainer to me to pass this legislation. There are some details about it, the way it's interpreted and this kind of thing that need to be gone through by the parliamentarians to make sure it's, it's correct, but the overall intent of the legislation, I think, is clear.
And the governor's office says that they will review the bill carefully. Yeah.
I was just going to say no-brainer, but you stole
that.
All right. And non-controversial, really.
Yeah. But apparently controversial enough that the legislation stalled on Capitol Hill at the federal level. But anyway, so let's move on to some news out of Washington this week. And one of them are some indictments coming out of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's ongoing investigation into Russian influence in the presidential election. Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign manager, and Manafort's business partner, Rick Gates, were indicted on conspiracy and tax fraud charges for things that went on before Paul Manafort joined President Trump's campaign, I should note. But Manafort's attorney, Kevin Downing, says the charges have nothing to do with Russian interference in the election.
Well, I think you all saw today that President Donald Trump was correct. There is no evidence that Mr. Manafort or the Trump campaign colluded with the Russian government.
And the president also insisted the same, that his campaign did not collude with the Russian government.
All I can tell you is this. There was no collusion. There was no nothing. It's a disgrace, frankly, that they continue.
Okay. Manafort and Gates. Go, Renee.
Oh, well, you know, I think that it's very bad news for President Trump. He can try to minimize this as much as he wants. But, you know, the grand jury is already sitting. And so and the wheels of this investigation are starting to, bite. I think the real October surprise, though, is not so much the indictments of Manafort and Gates, but the revealed guilty plea of George Papadopoulos, who is, again, the president is trying to say minor advisor to him, although there is tape with the president saying he's an excellent guy. That, I think, is the real problem for the president.
Yeah, so we should say that that George Papadopoulos did plead guilty to lying to the FBI. That's what he's pleaded on. But the things that he was lying about have to do with his actions as a campaign advisor during the campaign and his interactions with various Russians as well. So that does tie things directly to the campaign. Richard, your thoughts on that?
Well, I would just say that the indictment of Manafort happened were because of things that happened when he represented the Ukraine.
Right.
I think 7 years before. So Donald Trump's name was not even mentioned in the indictment. And I think my takeaway, and I think the real problem, that the October surprise that's going to pop up here, is the fact that Paul Manafort was working hand-in-hand with the Tony Podesta, who runs a lobbying campaign. And we all know that John Podesta, Tony's brother, was Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman.
But the emails.
But I think, and I'm not just, I don't want to get into a big Trump, anti-Trump thing. I think it shows how, you know, Washington is the swamp. And here you have Hillary's campaign chairman who had all these interactions and business relationships with Trump's campaign chairman. Mm. And the very day that the indictments came out against Manafort, and again, it's because of his representation of the Ukraine, Tony Podesta resigned from his company. And if you read the indictment, it mentions Company A and Company B. Company B is obviously the Podesta group, I think that has a lot to do with him resigning. And there's a lot more that's going to come out. And I think for people who look at Washington and are totally disgusted, again, this is off subject for Trump, but totally disgusted by the way things work and the role that money plays there. When this all plays out and is presented before the American people, I think they're going to be sick.
Okay. But what about George? I'm going to take you back to George Papadopoulos here because in his guilty plea and what came out there, he was trying to arrange meetings with high-level members of the Russian government.
He was an unpaid member of the campaign. From what I understand, he was
sitting at the table with Donald Trump in that photo.
But, you know, the Washington Post came out, and when Donald Trump announced his advisory committee on foreign affairs, his background and his number one, resume item was that he participated in Model UN. And the Washington Post...
This may say more about the Trump campaign
exactly. The Washington Post mocked him and said that this guy's a nobody. What is he? And then all of a sudden, now we're expected to believe, because of the indictment, and he obviously sounds like a very dumb person anyways.
But here's what I wonder.
Well, we're expected to believe, though, that he's a mastermind, and he's...
I don't think that's what we're expected to believe. Here's what I wonder. If you obsessively read over court documents, as I am wont to do, you see that in the documents surrounding the government's motion to seal the Papadopoulos plea, the government calls Papadopoulos a proactive collaborator, a proactive something.
Proactive cooperator.
Cooperator, exactly. Yeah. Now, I've seen a lot of legal analysts saying that that means he was wearing a wire, or he may have still been wearing a wire for many months between July, the end of July when he was arrested, and October 5th when he signed that guilty plea. So, you know, he might be a low-level guy, but he had access to higher-level folks within the Trump campaign. And I think we may just be at the tip of the iceberg in terms of what Robert Mueller has.
That's right. And I think he's sending a signal that, you know, he's being very tough here. I mean, he's going after Manafort and Gates with, criminal charges, which in some cases have in the past been just civil charges, failure to register as a foreign agent. He's clearly squeezing Papadopoulos, otherwise he wouldn't have made this agreement. So I think he's sending a signal to all of Washington, to all of the anybody else who might be called before the grand jury to we're taking obstruction very seriously. We're taking lying to the grand jury or to the FBI very seriously. And, I think he's being very... methodical and very tough. And I think it's going to make it very difficult, as much as the Trump administration would like to, brush this off as a flea. I think it's going to make it very difficult for them to advance their agenda on any other issue.
Yeah. So we'll see where this goes.
It's a nice segue.
I want to be able to just talk for another big story out of Washington this week before we turn to our hubbubs. And that is the GOP tax plan, the House tax plan, which was unveiled just yesterday. One quick piece of tape here. Here's how House Republicans talked about the goals that they see accomplished in this tax plan. Here's Speaker Paul Ryan.
So, yes, the focus is on middle-class tax relief. The focus is on directing that tax relief to the people in the middle and the people who are trying to get there. And that is why we put our emphasis on that tax relief for those people who are in the middle, who are working paycheck to paycheck, striving to get ahead. We've got to modernize our tax code so that we can be competitive again, so that we can keep jobs in this country, so we can keep businesses in this country.
Richard, your thoughts on it? It's a $1.51 trillion plan.
If nothing else, what I think is critical for the country, it's been 30 years since they've reformed the tax.
1986, right.
Last time is this corporate tax. It's got to be more in line so the United States companies can be more competitive around the world with similar companies. Right now we're at 35%.
35%.
Canada's at 15. Ireland's at 12.5.
This bill puts it at 20 now.
Most countries are 15 around the world. And what you've had is, because of the way our tax structure has worked, is you've had all these countries divesting from the United States, buying shell companies. There's trillions of dollars sitting overseas that could be coming back here, being used to reinvest in companies in the United States and to hire people. If all of the other stuff wasn't in the bill, and it was just the corporate tax rate, that would be huge.
But it's not the only thing in the bill.
Yeah, so actually, this is a really good point, though, Rich. I think you make an excellent point, because there's maybe not everyone, but I think you could find a consensus around
corporate
tax.
I want to just say President Obama, the Clintons, they've recognized how every day that goes by that we're at a disadvantage, we're divesting.
Yeah, and you could find a consensus on ways to get those offshore funds repatriated to the United States. But as you're saying, it's not the only thing in the bill. The bill's 400 pages long, and it touches absolutely everybody.
That's right. I mean, there's everything in there from, the estate tax to, removing the prohibition against churches having, who with their tax-exempt status, being able to get engaged in politics. So, I mean, there are so many things wrong with this bill. It's like, it reminds me of that old joke about the food is terrible, but the portions are so small. I mean, it's like the facts of the bill are terrible, and the process of ramming it through that's going on in Washington is also terrible. So it's hard to know where to focus first. I love that House Speaker Ryan is talking about how the focus is on the middle class, but the numbers are on the rich, or on corporations. And I just think that, we can debate the minutiae of this, and I hope we do, actually, and that this does become a debate where we're actually looking at what's in the bill instead of just ramming it through. But I also think we shouldn't lose that big picture, which is it's $1.5 trillion. Yeah. That's so much money. That's 1,500 billions. Here we are supposedly not having the money to renew the child health insurance plan, for example, and we need to be able to find compensating cuts in other children's health programs in order
to do that. But this
bill does not require offsets.
But the only way you get the money to do that is to grow the economy. And we've gone through a period of stagnation for almost a decade right now. It is interesting that the last two quarters would have the GNP rate has been 3%. And what's going to happen is, if this bill passes, particularly another good part is, I think, condensing to three tax rates.
Plus one from
what we have right now. No breaks for people over a million. Renee should like that. So you can't call it a tax for the rich necessarily. But the point is, I think if this passes, the economy is going to take off and we're really going to end up, revenues are going to increase. We're going to end up growing ourselves out of the mess that we're in right now. And there are so many, you can already tell in anticipation, the stock market's at record highs, the economy's really starting to do well right now, and this will really propel us. Trump calls it rocket fuel. I do think it's going to be a big win. There are a lot of
influential policymakers in Washington who are aligned with your point of view, but I think there are several economists as well who would say, it's debatable about whether or not massive tax cuts do lead to growth. In the Clinton years, we had tax increases, but we also had a record growth as well. So,
I mean, I wish it were true what Mr. Tsai here is saying. I would love to believe that, but I just don't.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I own a small business, and some of the provisions in this bill, I'm a subchapter S. It's going to allow me to buy new equipment. It's going to allow me to reinvest in my company.
Yeah.
And those are the things, and a lot of the small businesses aren't totally happy with the bill. But those are the types of things when you're making decisions, you're looking at what's coming down the road, and we're sending out a great signal if Aaron talking about this, and if it ends up passing, look out, the economy is going to go really well.
Yeah. In fact, one thing which I think a lot of small businesses would like is that the deduction for new equipment purchase is being raised by like 10 times, right? Up to like $2 million or something.
Right.
So that's great. I mean, that stuff is good. But again, it's all together in one bill.
It's going to be
a messy fight.
It's called sausage making.
Yeah. Look, we've made so much Week in Review sausage. We are actually out of time. So no hubbubs. Darn it. Okay. Can you save them for next time?
You bet.
Okay. Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston. It's always great to have you. Thank you so much. And Richard Tessay, former Republican minority leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. Thank you so much.
You.
We'll be back. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Election Day is on Tuesday, and Bostonians will vote for mayor on that day. WBUR's Edify reporter Max Larkin has been taking a look at education and how it plays out in this mayoral race. And he has covered both Tito Jackson and Marty Walsh's platforms on education, and he's with us now. Good to see you, Max.
Good to see you, Meghna.
Okay, so education has always been an issue in Boston for generations. So how is it playing out in this race?
Yeah, this is actually an anniversary year. It's been 25 years since former Boston Mayor Ray Flynn took mayoral control of the school district, replaced a group of elected school board members and put an appointed school committee in place. Flynn told me that he did it to make sure that parents and educators in the community have a voice in the direction of the district.
You know, I didn't really want control over the schools. You know, I wanted accountability. I just wanted a voice for people who didn't have a voice.
Flynn told me that he did it to make sure, but it had another effect, notionally putting in Boston's sitting mayor on the hook for whatever happens in what's a big and complex school district.
So that brings us to today then, because I want to ask you about what do both candidates see as the biggest issues then currently with Boston public schools?
Yeah, both candidates share some key concerns. They've got, the same ones you'd see everywhere: achievement gaps, holding back racial minorities, poor quality school buildings, better outcomes, really, in college and in careers. But I think they have differences of approach. Jackson's pushing for a lot more money. He says he'd put $45 million directly into Boston Public Schools, bypassing the central office to pay for the big and small things that principals and teachers want. But that they don't have the money for now. And Walsh, as the incumbent, says he doesn't want to spend taxpayer money, but he does want to expand pre-kindergarten in the city and to basically spend $1 billion to revamp the facilities in the district.
Okay, so you did take a very close look then at the platforms of both candidates regarding Boston Public Schools, and you've reported on it. I want to just go directly to your reported piece on how City Councilor Tito Jackson looks at Boston Public Schools, and basically he calls for more funding. So let's listen to your story.
Waving at cars at the edge of Franklin Park, Tito Jackson is on his home turf.
Thank you.
Jackson grew up less than a mile away in the Grove Hall neighborhood.
Thank you.
But he didn't go to high school in Boston. Born to a 13-year-old mother, he was adopted by parents who decided to take him out of the Boston public schools. Instead, Jackson went to Brookline High School as a Metco student. He graduated in 1993.
What my parents did is what every single parent in Boston is doing, is trying to do the best for their child.
Jackson says that a BPS education still isn't always a pathway to a bright future, no matter who you are.
So the real issue is that a young Martin J. Walsh and a young Tito Jackson wouldn't fare as well in a Walsh administration based on the funding that's currently happening.
School funding is at the center of the Jackson campaign. He emerged as a leading advocate for more spending on public schools in last year's debate over Question 2, which would have lifted a statewide cap on charter schools. Here he is at a Radio Boston debate last fall.
We should be coming together, as we started in 1993, to actually bring up all schools and all children and leave no child behind.
Question 2 went down in defeat by a nearly 2-to-1 margin. It was a major victory for Jackson, and he's been making the case for more spending ever since. Jackson says that if elected mayor, he'd reallocate $45 million directly to public schools in Boston. It's a big amount of money, on the heels of what was already a large infusion in last year's budget. Jackson says it would allow schools to add staff members sometimes seen as inessential, like computer science teachers, nurses, and social workers. But supporters of Mayor Walsh say it's not that simple.
More money is not alone going to do the trick, because we already spend so much and don't get the kind of return on that investment that we should get.
That's Marty Walls, a former state legislator who was on the other side of the charter debate last year. She points to a chart that shows Boston spends around $20,000 per pupil, markedly more than most of the nation's biggest school districts, and second only to New York. And yet, she says, about half of all BPS students attend schools that the state has labeled as underperforming. So while she supports increased funding, Wall says the district also has to change its ways to better serve low-income students and English language learners.
How do we do a better job educating the kids who are hard to educate? That's the duty of adults, is to figure this out.
City data show that BPS's funding has actually gone up by a little over 5% in the last 5 years. It now accounts for more than a third of the city's budget. But Jackson and his supporters respond with data of their own. Since 2012, BPS has relied on a formula in which the district's money follows its students. That means as enrollment drops at a given school, it can create a kind of death spiral, less funding, dwindling staff, and many students stuck there all the same. So says Kristen Johnson, a BPS parent who's supporting Jackson.
Their art teacher gets cut. They lose half a nurse. They lose their music. They lose their AP classes. It's an issue of quality and equity.
About half of Boston public schools have fewer teachers than they did when Walsh took office in 2014. Most have no working library. And around 50 schools will see cuts this year, many of them housing especially high-needs populations. Even the district concedes that recent funding decisions have been difficult. In a letter sent home to families last year, BPS Superintendent Tommy Chang blamed state and federal aid, which hasn't kept up with rising costs. But Jackson says he learned a lesson going to school in wealthier Brookline. Its citizens voted overwhelmingly to approve higher taxes to pay for education just 2 years ago.
And what I learned from Brookline is that's a school system where when money runs out, they make it work.
City Councilor Tito Jackson there in a story from WBUR's Max Larkin. And Max, as you had said before, Tito Jackson went to school in Brookline through the Metco program.
He did.
So it's an interesting sort of counterpoint here. But Max, I'm curious. So Councilor Jackson has talked for a long time about getting more money to Boston schools. Does he have a plan for where that money is going to come from?
I think he sort of does. He released what he called the People's Budget, and he said that he was going to direct more than, as I said, about $40 million out of projected increases in property taxes. So you got people moving into nicer buildings in the city. You're assessing a larger tax bill, and take about half of that and put it right into the schools. That's the idea.
Okay. So funding is sort of one piece of the puzzle here. And obviously it's an important one because Boston Public Schools are the single largest part of the city's budget. But, you know, as you touched on in your earlier piece there with Councilor Jackson, there's this issue of the persistent achievement gap in BPS schools and that the schools are not serving English language learners as much as they can or should be, or students with disabilities. I mean, how do Walsh or Jackson and Walsh plan to address those issues?
Well, first of all, they're not promising to solve them all in their first term. They're big, intractable problems.
Yeah, they're no magic wands.
Yeah,
right?
Every urban district faces those issues. But they do have their ideas. Walsh is betting on a body of academic research that says pre-kindergarten is the place to make the investment. Any dollar that you spend there will pay dividends down the line. He hasn't delivered on all of these high-quality pre-kindergarten seats, but he thinks that could make a difference in the quality of high school students and how they how they handle school. Jackson would go, I think, more comprehensively. He wants to end excessive discipline, suspensions, and expulsions for young children. He wants better youth jobs, MBTA passes, and then alongside a discretionary spend of $45 million, a big infusion of cash.
Okay. So we heard your piece there that went into detail with Councillor Jackson's sort of view on education. You did the same for Marty Walsh's platform and record on education. So let's listen to that.
It's a cold morning in Boston's Seaport District. But at the annual Ed Vester's Prize Breakfast in the Westin Hotel Ballroom, the mood is all warmth. The event is a love fest, celebrating excellent principals, teachers, and philanthropists, too. Then the guest of honor, Mayor Marty Walsh. Prize panel chair Jim Stone lists Walsh's educational accomplishments, like longer school days at about half of BPS schools, and a summer learning program. But most of all, Stone praises the mayor's consensus-driven approach.
He's done all this always by building alliances rather than pitting one side against the other.
As Walsh takes the stage with Election Day on the horizon, he's grateful for the compliment.
Thank you. Let me thank Jim. Thank you. I need to borrow you for the next 6 days.
As warring factions argue about the future of Boston Public Schools, its reputation as a top urban school district can sometimes be drowned out. But BPS does face big challenges and little agreement about how to fix them.
Boston is a full participant in, you know, one of the great problems facing our nation, which is the failure to unlock the potential of black and brown children.
That's Paul Grogan. He's the president of the Boston Foundation, a nonprofit group that supports charter schools and education reform. Grogan believes the BPS budget is bloated by excess staff and capacity, and that the district has to downsize before it can thrive. But he says he understands why Mayor Walsh has avoided making those deep cuts so far.
Now, closing schools is, in the political world, a very unattractive thing. Even terrible schools, it turns out, have some defenders.
Grogan says he hopes that in a second term, Walsh might take more decisive action against schools seen as failing. But teachers at one such school couldn't disagree more. Martha Boycell has taught English as a second language at Brighton High School for 14 years. It's the end of the day, and the school feels empty. In the past 5 years, its enrollment has dropped from around 1,100 students to fewer than 700. Its test scores have dropped as well, and last year the State Board of Education designated Brighton as an underperforming Level 4 school. Following district policy, teachers were asked to reapply for their jobs, or leave Brighton High. Boycell was one of the few to return. She says that fall from grace does weigh on her.
It really depends on the day. Some days you feel hopeful, and some days you feel completely devastated.
During her time there, she says Brighton's student body has changed dramatically. More recent immigrants, more students who are homeless or suffer from learning disabilities. They're wonderful kids, Boycell says, but ones that need more resources to educate, not fewer. Boycell says that in effect, the state has punished Brighton High for changes out of its control, and that the city hasn't picked up the slack. Mayor Walsh visited Boycell's classroom on the first day of school this year, but she didn't have a chance to make Brighton's case.
I would love to sit down and talk to the mayor about this. It's been hard to figure out who do we go to advocate for our students.
Walsh remembers that visit well. Back at the Westin Hotel, he rattles off facts about the population at Brighton High.
44% of the kids in Brighton High are English language learners, and if you look at the kids that took the 10th grade MCAS, many of those were brand new into the country, into the school. And by the time they were 12th graders, they were speaking proficiently in English.
He faults the state for failing to recognize that progress or provide the district with sufficient aid. Walsh has said he isn't planning to close schools like Brighton High, even if students flee for greener pastures. In a second term, he hopes to use special turnaround grants and a $1 billion rebuilding plan to bring new life back to those schools. But he's not letting them off the hook, either.
You can't continue to fund schools that are losing enrollment at high levels. Throwing money at a situation and not fixing the problem is not the answer.
It's a middle ground, one that leaves Walsh open to criticism from across the political spectrum.
I mean, again, everyone wants more.
That's the challenge for an incumbent mayor. Everyone does want more for Boston Public Schools. More funding, more accountability, and more progress. And all at the same time.
That's from WBUR's Max Larkin here. Max, one last question for you. I mean, we've been talking about education, always an important issue for the city, but how important is it in this election?
I think I'd turn your attention to the WBUR poll that shows that it's flipped places in the last 4 years. Used to be everyone's top issue, or a quarter of voters' top issue. Now that's housing. So it may not be driving this one quite as much as it did last time.
Oh, interesting. Well, WBUR's Max Larkin there bringing us the multiple views about education in the mayoral election in Boston. Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Magda.
We'll be back. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. All this week, WBUR's Bostonomics team has been exploring the future of work. Technology, artificial intelligence, gig employment, it's all creating shockwaves of change in how we work. Today, in our final installment of the series, reporter Bruce Gellerman looks at how manufacturing is changing in Massachusetts. Now, just 7% of the state's workforce is in manufacturing, but they produce 10% of the state's economic output. We'll hear a bit more from Bruce in a minute, but first, here's his report on how a new industrial revolution is promising to transform how things are made and the roles of workers.
The factory floor at Custom Machine Group in Woburn is filled with dozens of multi-million dollar metal cutting machines, some the size of SUVs. The place is spotless.
Yeah, it doesn't look like an old Rosie the Riveter machine shop, right?
Carl Pesciuto is president of Custom Machine, which mass produces precision parts.
Every machine that you see here has a computer on it. That's a multi-axis horizontal milling machine. It's all automated.
The guy that was standing there, is he running the machine at all?
All he does is load the component in, hits the button, and inspects after it comes out.
Welcome to Massachusetts' new industrial revolution, where workers armed with computing power and automation have made manufacturing a comeback story in the Commonwealth. Today, companies in the state literally make everything from soup to nuts, $48 billion a year worth of golf balls, razor blades, and jet engines, knee implants, missiles, even horseshoes. Carl Pesciuto.
There is nothing that is produced from clothing to food. Even the air in the room is processed by something. And when's the last time you saw an air conditioner tree that you could just pick an air conditioner off of? So this field is like the air in the room. Nobody notices it's there until it's gone.
Despite the heavy dose of factory automation, there's a critical shortage of skilled machinists who program the computerized tools, cut precision dies, and manage the complex manufacturing process.
It's your life. Your future. Now is the time to make something of it.
This is an ad for the Center for Manufacturing Technology. The Pesciuto family started the state-certified school a decade ago when it couldn't find enough skilled machinists for its plant.
Take pride in making it at the Custom Group.
Old school. Yeah, this is old school, and that's where we teach.
It's back to basics for Cosmo Pesciuto. He founded Custom Machine in the 1960s. Now he teaches a class in Metal Shop 101 to students, mostly immigrants, who start learning the machinist craft on an antique lathe that predates the company, before manufacturing jobs were lost to low-cost factories overseas.
We lost 40 years of old school, and we have to bring it back. We're looking for people, we can't get them, so we have to train them.
Today, a quarter of a million Massachusetts workers are employed in manufacturing. But less than 9,000 are skilled machinists. And Carl Pesciuto says they're in high demand.
We're not even playing catch-up. We're running way behind. They're gobbled up before they even graduated. We have pretty much 100% placement of everybody.
Machinist salaries range from $15 an hour, plus a lot of overtime for an inexperienced journeyman, to $150K a year for an expert. Those craftsmen who can mill a piece of metal with an artistic touch to within a few millionths of an inch.
It's really watching a Picasso get done in real time here.
Chris DiBiasio is group leader for advanced manufacturing at Cambridge-based Draper.
We actually don't even call them machinists at their highest classification here. We call them instrument makers.
Draper has its own in-house machine shop. Here, instrument makers turn computerized drawn art into precision parts. Small sensors, pumps, and components that can be implanted into people to deliver medicine, used in weapon systems, or sent into space. DiBiasio says a constant challenge is finding young machinists to replace retiring craftsmen.
Do they have the chops to be able to do real manual precision, you know, turning on a lathe or cutting with a mill? And if they have the hands-on skills, then you try to figure out, okay, can I then transform and take that next step into precision instrument maker?
DiBiasio leads the way off the noisy machine shop floor, through a door, leading into a new machine age.
This is the future of manufacturing now, right? That's what everyone will tell you, and this is our additive manufacturing facility. You see, it's a lot quieter.
Here, instead of computerized milling machines and skilled machinists, advanced whisper-quiet 3D printers add layer upon layer of materials, building complex components. Carl Bass is CEO Emeritus of Autodesk, a company that pioneered additive manufacturing software and 3D printing.
What we're doing with digital design and fabrication is rewriting the rules of the Industrial Revolution.
The price of 3D printers is dropping rapidly. Advanced materials, glass, metals, and plastics are being developed. And while additive machines can't print as precisely as skilled machinists can mill, Bass says that's quickly changing too.
What we're now able to do with these new kinds of digital factories is make things in small quantities where you get the same kind of quality you get in the large thing, but at that same low cost. It also leads to things like mass customization, and that's dramatically different.
A digital 3D factory is already transforming manufacturing in Massachusetts. Boston-based New Balance is using advanced 3D printers made by Somerville's Form Labs to produce custom-made running shoes. Catherine Petreca is with New Balance.
We're actually able to get information from you, either get data or what your preferences are, and make you that part on demand with printing in much better and shorter supply chain than we can with traditional techniques.
3D printers may never be able to produce a Picasso the way a skilled instrument maker can precisely mill a piece of metal, but advanced printers can make instruments. Alexander Gomenik worked at Form Labs while an MIT grad student. At a recent conference at the school called The Digital Factory, he played a nylon violin produced on a 3D printer.
In terms of design, it looks like Stradivarius, but it doesn't sound like Stradivarius yet.
It's predicted the overall number of manufacturing jobs in Massachusetts will hold steady in the near future. But 3D printers are a work in progress. On the horizon are printers that can replicate and manufacture other 3D printers. It's not possible. Not yet.
That report from WBUR Bostonomics reporter Bruce Gellerman. And Bruce is with us in the studio. Did you say at the end of it that there are 3D printers that can manufacture other 3D printers?
Well, not yet.
Not yet. So they'd be able to replicate themselves, though?
Exactly. You wouldn't even need workers, you know? It's incredible.
Wow. Well, yeah. That was, and I have to say the sound of that violin was quite haunting.
Mm-hmm. Not a Stradivarius.
Not yet. yet seems to be this... the theme here. Now, the technology, though, that we've been talking about, 3D printing, for example, has been around for decades. Where does it go next? Where is the yet?
Well, you know, we've come a long way, Magda, from like, you know, plastic tchotchkes like the tiny Eiffel Towers and, you know, Godzillas. But now the materials are getting much more sophisticated, much more advanced. Glass, I mentioned, metals that can tolerate different stresses and strains. Plus, then you've got the cost of these machines going way down. They're relatively cheap. And so you've got these new materials, you've got the cheap machines, and now you've got this data. That's the important thing. So you can mine data using sensors that can go on anything from you to a car, and then you have cheap microprocessors. That's almost not even negligible cost. And now you can produce, go right from data to product.
Right.
And the materials are very exotic. So they're talking about human biotissue, mm-hmm. making organs out of 3D printers, with 3D printers. I mean, skin, heart. It's mind-blowing.
Yeah. There have already been some 3D printed sort of harder cartilaginous materials that have been used in people, right?
Right, gels. They're starting, but their vascular system is the new breakthrough, and I'm going to be reporting on that in the near future.
Wow. Okay, yeah. Looking forward to that. Okay, so you know, given the sort of supply chain or the production chain, mm-hmm. you were just describing about, you could ostensibly go straight from data to an end product, mm-hmm. practically. that would put people at the beginning of the line, at the end of the line, but what about in the middle?
Well, exactly. Well, the thing is, we sent all these jobs overseas, right? Because the cheap labor, that was the reason they jobs went overseas. All the products, all the you know, the commodities, all the raw materials, those are worldwide prices. So really, it was the labor. Now, if you do away with the labor and a 3D printer, well, you know, the incremental cost of producing, you know, one or 1,000 is negligible. So, you know, who's going to buy your product? I'm reminded that Henry Ford. Remember, Henry Ford was the new industrial age. He mass production. You could have any car you wanted as long as it was black, right? And he mass produced them like crazy. Now, but what people forget is that he didn't just industrialize the factory, right? But he industrialized the workers. He produced people who could buy the products that they made, mm-hmm. right? And he was sure of that. Now, if you don't have workers making the products, where are the customers going to be to buy your products? So that could be, you know, the future of work could be the end of work.
Bruce, you know, a sobering but probably an apt way to end our conversation today. That's WBUR's Bostonomics reporter, Bruce Gellerman. Bruce, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
And by the way, WBUR's Future of Work series will conclude this afternoon on All Things Considered, where MIT economist Andrew McAfee is going to be talking about how machines, just like Bruce has been talking, will affect the future of work. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.